Hello, everybody. I, to this day, am still John Atack, though you never know what might happen during the next hour. I'll probably still be John Atack at the end, but I have written my name down on a slate for those of you who are fans of Alice Wonderland so that I can remember who I am at the end. And anyway, this is my dear, esteemed friend and colleague, Joe Zimhart. Hi, Joe.
Hello, John. Thanks for having me again.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, same here. Yeah.
And you're going to introduce our topic rather than me doing the usual 10-minute waffle before anybody else gets a word in edgeways.
Yeah, let me try to do this. This is a big topic. And, you know, I'll ask a question, but don't answer it. You know, what is dog spelled backwards? Right. So, as I was talking to you about, I had this book that I gave my mother back in 1991 when I got a publication from the author, sent it to me. And this is the book, and it's titled, What Do We Mean When We Say God?
Wow.
And Deirdre Sullivan did a survey around the nation and also looking at famous people that answered this question. So there's common, you know, answers from people who, you know, like, for instance, this 8-year-old, you know, from Princeton, New Jersey. And her answer was, God is like the light I turn on in my room. He lets me see what's there. Now, Heidegger couldn't have said it any better. But that's an 8-year-old. Okay, so let me go through some more of these. And then...
Please.
So here we have, if there were no God, it would be necessary to invent him. Voltaire.
Yep.
Right? Let's keep going here. Two things hold me in awe, the starry heaven above me and the moral law within me. Now, you know who that is. That's Immanuel Kant.
Hmm.
Right? Is one of his most famous saying. I think it might be in his obituary. Anyway, the energy of atheists, their tireless propaganda, their spirited discourses testify to a belief in God which puts to shame mere lip worshipers. They are always thinking of God. Fulton J. Sheen. And it is easier to think of the world without a creator than of a creator loaded with all the contradictions of the world. Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah.
Let's move on here. So, man is certainly stark mad. He cannot make a worm, and yet he will be making gods by the dozens. Jean-Paul Marat.
Yeah.
I'm a Christian. I see God everywhere. People want him to be. If you are in that part of God's kingdom that says Muhammad is the interface between you and God and you want to have a conversation with God, he's there for you. He's there for us all. Dwayne Lundgren, age 53, a deputy director of U.S. Army intelligence. And God is from whom we may not get what we want, but do find peace with what we get. Marilyn White, 58, lives in Chicago.
Okay.
When we talk to God, we're praying. When God talks to us, we're schizophrenic. Lily Tomlin, age 51, actress, Los Angeles.
The blessed Lily Tomlin, yes.
Yeah. And in my most extreme fluctuations, I have never been an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of God. Charles Darwin.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an important one.
Yeah.
Because he's often acquired by the atheist camp, and
very much so. Yeah, he had said in one statement that as far as a designer or a god, he chose to wave a white flag. He wasn't going to fight the idea.
No, and there's nice. a personal letter that he wrote to a friend where he took his supporter Thomas Huxley's word agnostic, and said that defines my position.
Interesting.
And people have said, well, that's just because his wife was, a hardcore Christian and he didn't want to upset her. But I think in his private letters, he probably wouldn't have been too worried about upsetting her. And it's a position I take myself. You know, I'm agnostic. I do not know.
Yeah, and I do not know that I do not know.
And there are known un-Rumsfelds and Rumsfeld right. unknowns, no, unknowable Rumsfelds.
Yeah. Okay, here's one you'll like. This speaks to our field. God is the electromagnetic field surrounding the earth out of which everything is composed. Gabriel Green, age 65, president of Amalgamated Flying Saucer Clubs of America.
Well, he'd know.
You like that one?
He would know, yeah.
Yeah, he would know. He's the president after all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this one, famous author, God is a fire and you must walk on it, dance on it. At that moment, the fire will become cool water. But until you reach that point, what a struggle, my Lord. What an agony. Nikos Katsizakis.
Zorba the Greek.
Yes, dancing on the fire.
Mm.
Okay, I'm just going to do two more.
Yep.
Okay, no one has ever died an atheist. And that's Plato.
Yeah.
Okay, now above Plato, this will be my last one, this person says, anybody can say they found God. It's a personal experience they're talking about. The problem is with any human statement is that it's in a context, and the context can always be examined. If the context doesn't reflect the high purposes and the high values and claims that the person is making about their experiences of God, then you've got a problem.
No.
And that was by Joe Simhart, age 42, deprogrammer, Santa Fe, New Mexico.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. So, you know, he's listed right above Plato here, which is.
Yes. Bad. Yes.
So that's the reason I sent this book to my mother back in 1991 when it came out. It was published by Doubleday. And there's a series of these kinds of books out there that are kind of small things you read while you're sitting on the commode or whatever and table chatter. But yeah, it's compiled by Deirdre Sullivan. So there you go.
Hmm.
I've opened up a flood of ideas, I hope. And
I've written nearly a really, whole page of notes while I've been listening.
I went to my quote at the end is this has basically been my approach about this whole problem of cults and whether they're good or bad or God or whatever. I'm not questioning the right of people to believe in that sort of thing or whether it's real or not. You know, what I'm questioning is how it's used. So that's the pragmatist approach. Is how is it used in social discourse? How is it used in a sentence? Mm. Does it make sense? Mm. You know, that kind of thing. And, this whole concept of the deity, the source of all things, the universe, seems to me to be more than not the main attraction of why people are drawn to a prophet, a guru, a new psychology, some inner deep answer that they're seeking to that transcendent idea.
Yes.
So anything trigger your your brilliant mind or your impish mind?
Impish, probably more likely. Yeah, I mean, it's a topic of endless fascination to me. When I was 13, I asked our religious instruction teacher if anybody other than Methodists would go to heaven, because he was a Methodist, and he paused, and to my amazement, and it was an Anglican school, he said, no, only Methodists will go to heaven. And that made me a bit suspicious, and the next week I said to him, could God ever forgive the devil? And I don't know where this came from. I hadn't thought about it. It just came out of my mouth. And he said no, and something changed in me. I'd grown up in the Anglican faith. I kind of believed it. At 11, I stopped going to church because I wanted to sleep in on a Sunday morning because I have a sleep disorder, you know. But my mum took it that I'd was moving away from the faith and never had a conversation with me about it. Mm-hmm. And so I stopped going to church, and then I didn't want to be confirmed in the Anglican church. All three of my older brothers were. And it just didn't feel right somehow. And at 13, I went, well, the God they are believing in, I don't believe in. Because I went to a nominally Christian school in a nominally Christian country where our head of state, our monarch, is also the head of the church.
Right.
Something that the American Constitution wouldn't allow for, I don't think. And I found that I was in a school where and it was a relatively prestigious school. Like, you know, it wasn't, I wasn't paying fees, but there were boys who were, or their parents were. And on the one hand, we were being told we needed to imitate Christ. We needed to behave like Christ, you know. Mm-hmm. So I kind of looked at the Gospels and, it, you know, he who would follow me must give all that he owns to the poor. And I took that as, you know, he meant that. Right. And yet what I was actually being taught alongside the imitation of Christ was to become a rapacious capitalist, and that really success in the world is, you know, he with the best toys wins.
Or is blessed by God.
Yeah, is blessed by God. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, Joseph Campbell points out that, you know, when he went searching to prove the Jungian unconscious, the collective unconscious, because mm-hmm. all of these stories emerge all around the world. So in his first significant book, Hero with a Thousand Faces in the 1940s, he sadly bursts the Jungian myth and says, no, we can trace the root of these stories. And what happened is that in Sumeria, somebody got the idea of this divine presence that would then be channeled through them, their king, the person in charge. And that's how our society has worked ever since. It doesn't have to. There are societies like the Indus Valley, the Mohenjo-Daro civilization that lasted for 700 years, as far as we can tell, without religion, without kings, and without warfare.
Well, but they had chthonic gods, meaning earthbound gods, like
yes.
the water, thunder, Agni. Yeah, one of the spirit, most ancient gods was a fire god.
Which brings yeah. us into how God was invented, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, Machir Eliade's work on that, though he was a little bit of an odd human being, as was Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, I think what we tend to think in the West of God is what's been known as a sky god. And that Mohenjo-Daro culture was taken over by the Aryans that came in from Persian area, who brought their sky gods with them, and they adapted a sky god named Indra from the Greek model of Zeus, which yeah. spread around the area. And so that's how India got its sky gods. And yeah. Indra was the primary Zeus-like character that went and now was male and dominated the earth gods, which tended to be female or neutral.
Yeah, and often yeah. came in threes.
Yes.
So I mean, Robert Graves' hypothesis was that the Greek myths show the movement of a patriarchal culture taking over a matriarchal mm-hmm. culture. So the stories are about some, you know, Perseus or whoever defeating three women. Okay. And whenever we get those threes, we're looking, it would seem, at a matriarchy which possibly existed for hundreds of thousands of years prior to this patriarchal push, which, you know, we're seeing in our own time, hopefully the tail end of that, you know, gender enmity. You know, hopefully there are people who are understanding that we shouldn't have male versus female. We should have male and female working together.
Well, you know, I would think even in the origins, there was no distinction between matriarchal and patriarchal when it came to the forces, the gods of nature. You know, I don't think the thunder god was necessarily matriarchal. I don't, or patriarchal. I don't think although when you look at early astrology, it was mostly moon-centered, not sun-centered in the Canaanite culture and where it originated. And so moon has been associated with the feminine, no matter where you go, because of menstrual cycle and all that kind of thing. And the idea that somehow we emerge from the night, and we emerge from wombs, which are night, which are dark, and the moon shines in the night. You know, this kind of association, I think, was just common among.
And there are three days of darkness every month. And so,
yes,
so many myths have the 3 days involved in them until resurrection occurs.
Before you're born again, right.
And right. I mean, for me, it's sort of, I was thinking about Gerald Edelman, who the neuroscientist who he called God the generator of diversity, G-O-D. Mm-hmm. And, but he also, one of the things he said is that if you want to understand what the process of evolution is and how it functions, look at the development of the human brain. Look at the, you know, you can see step by step what is happening. There's a process one could call natural selection. There's a process of choice, which one could call the equivalent of sexual selection. Then there are the random things that happen around, which we might call epigenetics. And then finally, you have the fourth dimension of evolution, which is cultural transmission. Now, that one, for me, you know, we're both of us students of religion. We're both of us people who've been absolutely fascinated by belief, while probably standing a little to one side of belief, because, you know, the careers we've chosen meant we've had to understand to some extent the nature of belief. And to get back to Immanuel Kant, the idea that there is a real world around us, but every one of us has our own perception and interpretation of that world. Mm-hmm. So there are as many gods as there are people, but I think for you and I, what's perhaps different is that we don't feel insistent upon converting anybody to our own way of looking at the world. And we are perfectly willing to tolerate, as you said at the beginning, what other people believe, as long as what they believe doesn't lead them to act in an antisocial fashion. You know, so the thuggies believed that Kali wanted them to garrot people on the road and steal their stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think the difference between what we call a cult leader, a malignant cult leader, is someone who cannot abide the possibility of their ideas converging with someone else's that's living. You know, so a reasonable person looks for convergence. Now, it might not be absolute and complete convergence, but we can think alike about something. And that helps us to communicate. And we agree on a term, whether shades of meaning change according to who we are, because we grasp reality according to how this brain is set up. It's just like a bee grasps reality according to its nervous system, the way it's set up, which is completely alien to us. We don't see the way a bee does. We don't build homes the way a bee does. We don't interact the way they do, which is matriarchal culture. Completely.
Well, is it a matriarchal culture?
I don't know, is it?
I think the queen bee...
I thought the queen bee was the
matriarch. Yeah, it's a misnomer, because the queen is the only bee in the hive that doesn't direct the hive.
Right. So she's kind of a slave to the hive in a way.
Well, she's an aspect... Yeah, there's a way of looking at bee colonies, ant colonies, termite colonies as being single individuals.
Yes.
Composed of many elements. And one of the breakthroughs in study of honeybees, and of course there are hundreds of different types of bee, and that they don't all hive together, that they're different cultures among bees. But hive bees, it was found about 20, 30 years ago, that when they have to move location, scout bees will go out and find places, and they'll come back and dance. And eventually a location will be chosen by the democratic majority. And so bees have been thought of as the model of dictatorship, and fascism are in fact the most perfect democracy.
Interesting.
So we get into strange ideas there. But so much, you know, so much to say in the words of
Dave Matthews. The theosophical people that I was involved with and I think Church Universal, some of them taught this as well, that bees are not native to planet Earth. They were a gift from the gods of Venus.
Oh, that's nice of them. Where the temperature is what? An average of 400 degrees centigrade.
Come on.
The bees are made of asbestos. You know, Ron Hubbard said that we've been invaded by the fourth invader force from Venus and the fifth invader force from Mars. And you're going, yeah, really? Not much living on Venus, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, Rudolf Steiner said that the Christ in his ascended state sent the Buddha to Mars to convert the Martians to Buddhism.
Wow.
This is back in 1910. Oh, yeah. You can look it up.
Yeah. I wonder how that went.
So the people of Mars are actually Buddhists.
So the War of the Worlds is complete nonsense. They're actually all Buddhists.
Yes. Yeah. They wouldn't fight. Yeah.
I'm going to throw in, and it's the only thing I know by him, and it's because one of my brothers had it on his wall when I was a kid. There was this little sign, and it says, Dieu me pardonnera, c'est son métier. And it's Heinrich Heine, and translated, I believe it means, God will pardon me, it's his job. And that's one way of looking at it. Then you've got, is it Pascal's wager that you You might as well believe in God, because if you don't and he exists, you're in trouble. But I'd say, well, it's going to depend on which God you believed in. If you didn't believe that God was a spider, then, you know, he who harms the little fly shall fear the spider's enmity, as William Blake said.
Right. So I asked this question to start, you know, what is dog spelled backwards? Well, part of the problem I have with the God thing is that a lot of groups and leaders treat God like a dog that they can actually send out through a command. And this is true all over the world. You know, for instance, a Buddhist might go up on the mountain where there's a prayer wheel and spin it. And the belief is that that energy, those prayers go out and do things, you know, kind of like you might send a dog out, a messenger out to do something because you spun this prayer wheel. And this seems to be a very primitive form of prayer and communication with the so-called God, I think, that's pervasive. And it becomes almost a cult in itself when you get something like a New Thought cult that believes in affirmations to the extent, like the I Am did, that you could command God's energy and God will have to respond. You know, it comes from a mistranslation of Isaiah 45:11 in the Bible, where it says, command ye me and the things of my hands, said the maker. And it's in the Old King James, but it's a mistranslation. It shouldn't be. It said, how dare you command me, is what the translation should be.
And one thinks that that would be more likely, all in all, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
we gain power by believing this, that we can gather together in prayer, bow down, put our hands up in praise, and urge God, urge our dog to go out and do things for us, you know, according to the dog's will, of course. But of course, if you allow a dog to do its own will, it won't do much for you at all.
And you'll have to clean up afterwards.
And you will.
Yeah.
And you might get arrested because it might have bit somebody out there off its leash.
Exactly. So we have to be very careful about it.
You got to be really controlling of this particular God dog thing. You know, you can't just let it do anything it wants. Its own will. You can't allow it to have its own will.
Yeah. And it is caught up in, if we go back to the origins of Yahweh, Jehovah, whatever we're going to call him, then we find he is born of he comes out of the Babylonian pantheon. He's one of what, 72 gods, and he's a war god. And we hear about his brother Baal-Marduk as the golden calf in the desert. We hear various things about Astarte or Ashtaroth or Asherah, who's his mother, when we go back to the Babylonian ring seals. And so he's part of a community of gods. And the reason that the Habiru, or Hebrews, pick on him is he's a war god. And Exodus 11 makes it pretty clear that he's a fairly genocidal creature at that time, that he wants them to kill all of the Canaanites, all of the people they find there, man, woman, and child. It's the first record of a genocide in history. It probably didn't happen. Right. But, you know, there's no evidence that it did.
A wish that it would happen.
Yes, and there's a contempt towards other people, that sense of we are the chosen people, your lives are not worth anything, the typical dispensing of existence at the end of Lifton's, and that's not acceptable. But the reason, he's a war god, and they are warriors, and they, you know, they're Shemites, they're like the Babylonians, like the Arabs, they fight wars. And they then have to keep the name of their god secret. It's only spoken once a year in the Holy of Holies. I'm not sure that anybody knows what it actually is anymore. Tetragrammaton, Yahweh, what have you. But the idea is you mustn't let anybody else know the name of your god, because then they can bribe him with gifts of burning pigeons and things like that. So
that's the point that I'm making. You can, you to control this god, you have to expiate its moods. You know, if it's not spitting, not raining, like the Aztecs, you have to capture slaves and tear out their living hearts and throw them down the temple steps to get Chalk to budge, to bring the rain.
Or he's hugely partially to bring the sun up. Or
which is interesting. You know, this is kind of like it's a theme, and it still exists very much in today's religions. And especially in the cults, it comes out a lot more sharply in that if you do this, you get that, you know. And of course, you know, in Scientology, if you do this, pay all this money out and go up the bridge to total freedom, you're going to get that, which is, well, you know, a piece of blue sky or whatever, but you're going to get it. Yeah.
And what you're getting is a magical power. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, one of the differentiations that's made in religious studies is, of course, between you have the devotional religions like bhakti yoga, where you're worshipping something and hoping to get something back. Then you have the magical groups where you are seeking to control divine forces, supernatural forces, external mm-hmm. spiritual forces. And then you have the mystical path, which originally was part of the magical path, as far as I can work out. But mysticism has come to mean the kind of refining of the self, the intellectual process of seeking to find and face the truth. So pure Buddhism starts as very definitely an anti-magical belief, mm-hmm. and then turns into this sense of, oh, we have all of these bodhisattvas and all of these tulkus who will be reborn. And it becomes, you know, in Vajrayana Buddhism in Tibet, it becomes absolutely, you can't separate it from the Bonpo magical tradition.
No. In fact, you know, in some sense, some people in the past have compared that form of Buddhism to Catholicism in its more primitive forms, you know, where you have the demons and the saints and the statues of them and all the stories about them. And you can invoke the gods and invoke the saints and invoke, you know, and so, I mean, this is the part of Catholicism that the more cleaned up aspects of Protestantism wanted to reject, and maybe rightfully so, you know, to the point where they become so austere, they're practically Zen, like in Quakerism, you know.
Or the ultra Puritans who
yes.
just have no fun at all, which is, you know, right. What a dreadful way to go. Right. And yes, I mean, there are so many ways into this. One of them is, you know, when I, as sort of 17, 18 year old, was calling myself a Buddhist and went to a Soto Zen temple and learned to meditate and all this. I had friends who were involved with the Krishna temple. I knew nothing about that other than George Harrison singing the Hare Krishna mantra and My Sweet Lord, the song he stole from the chiffonier. But we won't get onto that chiffonier.
He's so fine. Yeah.
She's so fine, exactly. And so I didn't know anything about this. As far as I was concerned, they were Hindus. And one of them explained to me that I was an impersonalist and he was a personalist. And it took me a while to grasp this idea that he and his friends and Christians and Muslims, Jews, see God as a person. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Buddhism, there's the idea, or say in Taoism, there's the idea of a force, which mm-hmm. Buddhists start to reify and turn into something by calling it Buddha mind. With Taoism, you have this idea that there is, everything emerges out of some sort of force, but that force has not been reified. It's not been turned into something concrete.
Basically it's a contentious force because it moves in and out of darkness and light, in and out of itself. Which is interesting. It's almost cosmological in terms of how we see the universe today, moving in and out of black holes and into light and into darkness. You know, it's an interesting analogy when you think about how long ago it appeared.
Yeah, I mean, I was blown when I was 17 and first read a version of the Tao Te Ching. I was just completely blown away because I was not religiously inclined. I was very confused. And here was this text, which wasn't about what I ought to believe and the thou shalts and thou shalt nots. It was a speculation about how the universe came into being and what's going on. And this idea of, you know, I don't know what this thing is, so I will call it Tao. Mm-hmm. But of course it has no name. And it fascinated me for long enough that I ended up reading more than 60 versions of the Tao, more than 50 commentaries, and making two translations of it over the years, the first of which was terrible, and the more recent one is probably okay. But character by character, going through it, going through commentaries to seek to understand it, because this is more comparable to Plato and Aristotle, the Greek philosophers, because this is an attempt to understand, rather than a rule book of, you know, how we're supposed to live according to somebody in the Bronze Age.
But yeah, did you ever get into the I Ching, which is based on Taoism, the trigrams, the eight?
The I Ching works alongside Taoism. It's one of the classics, one of the Jings. And yes, I read it. I sought to use it predictively because I was about, say, 17. I read Jung's statement about it.
Right, I have that book. Yeah,
and I came to think that it was a philosophical construction. Mm-hmm.
I used to use it back in the day, mm-hmm. right before I got into the cult thing.
Didn't you have a coin to flip? You know.
Yeah, you could do the coin. You could do the sticks. You know, you could do whatever. What's fascinating to me about it is that one of the origin stories of it was that whoever came up with it saw it on the back of a turtle.
So it is said the original hexagrams.
Yeah, the original hexagrams.
Or trigrams, I think, originally.
They're trigrams, right.
Yeah.
Which makes me think that we can't easily stay in that cloud of unknowing, you know, just the Tao itself. We need to dumb it down. We need to make trigrams. We need to, and Taoism is full of gods and goddesses and whatever, and it's
like Buddhism. Their movements.
So for some reason, we have to dumb that down. We have to come out of the cloud of unknowing, which is one of the famous doctrines in Christian mysticism.
St. John of the Cross.
Fascinating book, yeah. Author unknown, basically, but which is good. It makes it even better.
Mm. Well, as with Lao Tzu, you know, we don't know anything about it. It's all made up.
We don't know much about that. Chang Tzu refined it somewhat. This seems to be a theme that you go from, and even in Hinduism especially, you go from this very refined, almost cerebral or mystical path toward this unnameable God, immutable God, infinite God. And you have to dumb it down in order for it to be useful. You've got to build buildings. You know, you've got to do, like in the ancient culture, a practice. You have to have, what am I trying to say? There has to be a practical application. There's got to be an Oracle of Delphi. There has to be something to allow the person to interact with this, and that thing can become a trap, is the problem, unless it's managed really well. So I'm not saying get rid of the things. I'm just saying have really good management that knows when to let go and when to hold on and when to change things. You know, which is what a good religion basically does. It changes over time. It adjusts itself. It you know, makes some kind of adjustments to science, to social changes, to, you know, and corrects its own past. You know, we see that happening in some cases.
That's what I'm saying about evolution, that religion shows us that, you know, because, for example, with Judaism, because we now do have access to so many Babylonian ring seals, we know that the original story of Adam and Eve, it's well represented in the Babylonian seals, that Adam and Eve are being invited into the garden by the serpent, who is the father god, on behalf of the mother god, who is the supreme god, to taste the dates, because there weren't apples in that part of the world at that time, to taste the dates of wisdom. And this, with time and retelling, becomes expulsion and an apple, you know, as in Snow White. And the serpent becomes a demonic figure rather than the father. And the mother goddess disappears from the picture entirely.
Right.
And we can... This evolution, I mean, the second book of Kings has the king, I think, of Judea rather than Israel, but one or the other, whose people find the book of the law, I don't think they mean the Aleister Crowley one, in the temple, And it says, you're doing it all wrong. And he overthrows the shrines. He kills the priestesses. And it's recorded in Torah, in the Old Testament, right there. And you can date it. And the reason you can, and he brings the patriarchal religion. So this is in, I think, 621 BC, somewhere close to there. And we can date it because the Egyptian chronicles show them invading that part of the world at that time and killing Josiah, which was his reward for bringing Jehovah to the masses. That gives us a date before which the Jews do not appear to have been an essentially monotheistic people. We then get the invention, probably, of Moses and the Egyptian captivity. And this whole set of stories that are refined and made better and better, you know, the same way that Shakespeare got the Decameron and turned it into these incredible plays, but he didn't write any original stories. And so we can see these stories changing over time to suit the priesthood of the time. So after the Babylonian captivity in what, the 5th century BC, the Assyrians release all of the Hebrews. They say, we're just sick and tired of listening to these people. They never stop bloody talking about philosophical matters. Send them home. And a guy called Ezra gives us really the beginning of modern Judaism.
Interesting.
So anything and everything, you know, we've become, our history, our scientific history has become better and better. We've not found any of the, you know, Solomon's temple or any of the great palaces and things that are boasted about in the Old Testament. And it's, you start coming to the thing, it's like, I hate to say this, and I am going to get into trouble, but it's like taking the Marvel comics and saying, right, this is our religion, let's fit everything around.
Well, you know, I think you're onto something, because when you look at the Homeric myths, Iliad and the Odyssey, there were many Homers that refined that tale. It was a progression of reciters and
people
that corrected things and added things, hundreds of years. So there was no just one Homer, just like there may have been not one Moses, you know, because this is the way people did things back then, but they put a name on it. They slapped a name on it, you know, just like, you know, modern Christianity slaps the name that Jesus inspired this particular gospel. There may have been one person that you know, as far as we know, that had a tremendous effect, a follower of John the Baptist, on this. But after he was crucified, there was a retrofitting of imagery and retelling, and suddenly, you know, we had Gnostic versions, we had you know, the Pauline version, you had Marcion,
and the Johannine version, where there is no childhood, there is no virgin birth, that none
So
all of which seems to be retrofitted, as you say, to fulfill prophecies in the Bible.
Yeah, to make something cohesive out of it. Like I was saying earlier, you know, people have something in their mind, and rather than stay all alone within their own schizophrenic world, they want to share it and see what's convergent, because that's one definition of truth, is where information converges in social discourse, we accept that as the truth. Not absolutely, but it's what we agree to. It comes to an agreement. And, you know, just like astrology, for instance, is a classic example. The Ptolemaic system still rules most of astrology, and even though it's been thrown out the window since Copernicus, but there's a consensus reality, we call it, but there's a convergence and an acceptance of this kind of thing. The same with the Tarot and other occult things that developed over time, and there's many versions of it, but there's a sort of a consensus. This is what we agree to, and then we work with it. And I mean, this is what's difficult, I think, for a lot of people in their particular religions and cults to understand, is that, hey, you know, you're full of flaws. And, you know, unless you start working it, whether it's you personally and your system outside of you, you're both are full of flaws. And unless that's reworked and continually refined, it will collapse into decadence. You know, you got to continue to clean house all the time. If you don't, you'll be invaded with mice and roaches and whatever.
Yeah,
basically what happens to these stilted religions. Like Scientology became stilted. You know, it couldn't change once Hubbard in his madness set it down.
No, and it is regarded as inviolable scripture now, which is rather difficult, as he contradicted almost everything that he said. Yeah. somewhere, and he said a lot.
This is the problem with the fundamentalist evangelicals that want to see the scripture as inerrant, as if it's Moby Dick. You know, that's the way it was written, and that's the way it has to be. You know, like it's some kind of a thing. Well, it's it's a living document. It's not a fictional novel, which is set in time. This is the way it's written. This is the way it has to be. But the Christianity isn't a novel. And I think a lot of fundamentalists see it as such. They think that it's a story much like Moby Dick. And you can't change a word of it, because then you will offend the author. And he'll sue you.
And you absolutely probably will these days. And it comes down to literalism, you know, the idea of fundamentalism of interpreting the material literally. And we come to some very serious problems there. So when
we've seen the serious problems come up, you know,
Jesus says, if your right eye offend thee, pluck it out. If your right hand offend thee, cut it off. I've not met a single Christian who's done that.
No, there's been some.
Well, there's Origen who cut his testicles off. I'm aware of that.
Origen did, but schizophrenics in my day that I've heard stories of in hospitals, because I've worked in it 25 years, one cut his hand off. Mm. Voices from his head saying, like God saying, you have to cut your hand off. It offends you.
And that kind of shows you what state of mind you need to be in to think that's a literal statement.
And we then
have the whole sense of, how much of this is metaphor? How much of this are these moral tales? You know, it's easier to get a rich man into the kingdom of heaven than to get a camel through the eye of a needle. And whether the eye of a needle is a gate into Jerusalem or a literal needle doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. Because my revelation in school at 13 was that I was being taught to make a big camel and try and shove it. That was the objective of life, to become rich, to become powerful. I also like to say that, and because this thought just struck me, and it seems quite significant, that devotional religions, where you just accept what you're told, and you now do, you go and kiss the icons and crawl on all fours to a shrine 1,000 miles away, you follow all of these rules. This is authoritarianism. This is magical stuff is psychopathic. It's the idea that you can control the forces of nature using your will. For me, that's a horrible notion, because it means that you're seeking to control other people without their consent.
Harry Potter,
yeah, that's what it is. There is no white magic, because all magic is an attempt to control others without their permission. A love talisman that makes somebody fall in love with you, what have you. So the magical stuff is dangerous there. The devotional stuff has put us in the mess we're in, where people just do as they're told. And in between is this mysticism, this idea of you find it out for yourself, work out how to behave. And, say the way that Baruch Spinoza managed to upset the Jewish community by asking questions and was expelled and lived on the same street as Rembrandt, which is such, at the same time, what a thought, Spinoza and Rembrandt. the one of the most brilliant philosophers of all time and one of the greatest egomaniacs of all time, who was in fact right when he said he was the greatest painter in the world. But that this sense of having to submit, Islam, surrender. Now, if it's surrendered to a benevolent force in the universe, I'm all for it. And I think often it is. I mean, when I read Mavlavi, Rumi, or Hafez, I feel that I am, that much closer to whatever it is that's out there. These men seem to have a tremendous insight into something quite beautiful and quite benevolent. But it's also said of Rumi that he introduced the whirling dervish thing, which is still done for tourists to this day, where you put your gravestone on your head and twirl around until you get really dizzy. And it said that he introduced this technique because it was forbidden. Both dancing and music were forbidden. And he wanted to show that these rules are to be broken.
Okay.
But there is then the sense that in every generation, you have to break them again, because you become set in, the customs and rituals of a past generation, which are no longer providing people with insight into the nature of life and reality, and tolerance for others and goodness. Let's unwind that word God. It's cognate with the word good.
Yeah,
they come from the same place, and I fear that so much that people, in trailing their, putting their God on a lead and trying to trail him around, they forget goodness, that fundamental underpinning. Other people have said God is love,
and in a sense we're arguing for cults to appear, because it's a challenge to status quo. It's a challenge to break up what's not good about, like, for instance, not good about the basic church. And you have some new preacher coming up thinking he's going to purify it and bring it back to the origin story of and we have thousands
unite all of humanity under his banner,
and then unite all of humanity, and then you have this grandiose leader claiming he's the new prophet or whatever. So it's a dangerous task, and Nietzsche said this, that how did he put it, that we're kind of born in chains, but it's not good to throw off your chains if you're not worthy of doing that. You're better off staying in the tradition you're in. And he meant that seriously. Stay in Christianity unless you are worthy of breaking free from it and doing something better. So he was careful in that. He wasn't just rejecting the old way. He didn't want to reject it. He rejected its calcification. He rejected its minimizing the value of the God. And so he warned people not to cast off their chains, because you could end up in a worse mess.
Yeah, no.
And yet his whole thing was about casting off those chains.
Yeah,
personally,
the dragon thou shalt not. I think there's something very interesting. It's all very interesting what you just said, but this point about we'll get cults because we need disagreement, and it makes me think, well, there's nothing wrong with cults per se, with groups that have devotion to a particular leader or doctrine. And if we look at science, what we want is people who come along and disagree, that the method should be constantly challenging ideas to find something better. And a lot of it with religion is, what is your basic beginning point? Mm-hmm. I had a conversation with the Archbishop of Crete. We spent 4 or 5 hours together. Absolutely brilliant man, Irenaeus. Absolutely wonderful man. And once he'd realized that, his miracle stories about Christianity weren't going to work on me, in fact, the exact story he told me, I'd been told by a Muslim 10 years before, about you pray and suddenly you get this stuff. And it's like, I'm really not interested in that. I'm interested in how I live. And he said to me, well, what do you believe? And I said, well, I believe in compassion. And I try to show it. And I know the meaning of the word humility. And I hope one day to have some. And nothing much has changed in the 9 years intervening. I still feel that, what is the beginning point for your belief? And my belief is, as Charlie Chaplin and Einstein said, I'm a patriot of the human race. Mm-hmm. I do not see myself as a white middle-class cis male and in this little box that says who I am. I believe in equalism, that we should all have the same rights and opportunities, but I believe fundamentally in being positive, doing good things, ameliorating the human condition. And if we start there and then take our perception of the divine, whatever that is, whether it's personal or impersonal, and say, because I decided I couldn't worship the Christian God who was being presented to me because he was a monster. All evil comes from the Lord. I think is it Leviticus or Deuteronomy? There's this, just this one-liner, all evil comes from the Lord. The idea, of course, of Satan, the opponent, is he comes up, what, 3 times in the Old Testament? He's really not significant.
And then, he's another developed concept. He's
an alter ego of God.
Well, the alter ego of the God in our mind.
Yeah. That idea of division becomes paramount in Christianity with the invention of hundreds of demons, the renaming.
You know, but what's interesting here is, and I think some preachers pick this out, you know, like let's use the Christian gospel, for instance. Yes. You know, you get these parables, which was a fascinating way to teach. And you get like the parable of the talents, and there's two versions of it. And, you know, and then someone gets one talent, someone gets five, another gets 10. Mm-hmm. And it's very simply speaks to what is, you know, there are people born into this world who are blind or who end up crippled or who die young, you know, or who have very low IQ.
I have for whatever reason. IQ.
Yeah. You know, and I worked in an institute for brain damaged autistic for 2 years when I was younger, and I understand what that is viscerally, you know, hands on. Yeah. People that are born into this state where some of them are just vegetables for 15 years until they die, you know, and people help to keep them alive.
Yes.
You know, so, but some are given a little bit, some are given more and other. And what's expected of us, and this is the idea where the good comes in, is to do better with what we have. The parable, I think, works very well. And I think I've used it in exit counseling cases to show that your group is really not allowing you to exploit your talents, who you are. You know, if you're in a Christian type group, what are you doing there? What you buried your talents into this small group and it's exploiting it and no one else benefits from it, you know? So, you know, you get someone like a Charles Darwin, who's barely a believer, but he puts his talent to incredible use. He took a risk, and he came up with something which is a valuable scientific idea, theory, if you will, that's become extremely useful for other scientists to build on and to use. You know, so in a sense, that's what that parable to me is talking about. It's taking what you have and doing the best you can with it and increasing, you know, with whatever circumstances you're under, if you can. And you know, but if you're in a nation like North Korea, the whole thing oppresses that ability to flourish, as Aristotle would say. You know, so in a way, the parable of the talents is like Aristotle's idea of flourishing. That's the purpose of life, eudaimonia. And so, you know, that's what I think the whole thing comes down to in the sense of God is what, how do you use God in order to allow yourself and other people to flourish, even people that don't believe in your God?
Yeah. How do you, I mean, I've started thinking in quite simple, almost simplistic terms that the people are pro-social, antisocial, and the vast majority are asocial. Mm-hmm. And so to have that motivation, if you want to be religious, then start by being pro-social. Start by, you know, by wanting to do good for others. I'm often asked about therapy. I'm not a counselor, but I've helped about 600 people in their recovery from, particularly from Scientology, but from one or two other groups as well. And it sort of, so people will say, well, what is the vital element of that? And for me, the vital element is I like people. Mm-hmm. And when I meet people who are counselors, because they have some narcissistic urge, or they want, you know, they want to be adulated, or they tried to solve a problem using a therapy, believe they have solved it, and now have to use that therapy on everybody else because they haven't really solved it, that there is something that's a therapeutic personality, and it boils down to, do you like people? And I think if you don't like people, then your religion will be a bad thing, whatever it is, because you will use it to hurt others. Whereas if you like people, then, and have compassion, have some fellow feeling.
Let me build on this, because this is our problem with the narcissistic leader, is they like people that like them. Yeah. So there's liking is conditional.
Yeah.
In those kinds of groups. Yeah.
Yeah. And as Alex Stein points out, you get a disorganized attachment where you go to the leader both for praise and punishment, and you don't know which one you're going to get.
I just heard one of her talks recently.
Yeah.
John, I've got to go in a few minutes here.
Okay.
Let me go see my mom. You have anything more profound to say?
God, no, not at all. No, let's just throw one Spaniard in the works, as John Lennon had it, which is Stephen Hawking. Hawking's famous bet that when the background microwave radiation was discovered, and it was found that it wasn't, in fact, the pigeons mating in the radio telescope, but they'd actually found that this you could measure the same signal in all directions, which made it possible to date the Big Bang. And at this point, Hawking won a bet, which I think was a subscription to Playboy magazine. These are old misogynistic days when he made this bet, probably. And because he said, well, that means that God could exist. And the funny thing was that the week that that came out, which was back in the 90s, I think, you know, way back, in another century, I was reading a book by a Methodist minister who was seeking to say that, in fact, steady state would be a proof of the existence of God. So the only two theories we have, both of them are capable of proving the existence of a divine force. I think the underlying message and the thing, you know, that we've been talking about is about your moral intentions. And if you justify harming others through your religion, or if you refuse to listen to other people. I was sat in a room with some friends, and we were about to talk to the parents of a Scientologist, and they were Christians. They're born again Christians. And I started talking about the historicity of Christ, what we do and don't know. And we don't know anything fundamentally. We've just got Josephus, and that's a questionable text, the Jewish Wars. But there's nothing else that's contemporary other than what was written down by John and the followers of Paul, Matthew, Mark, Luke. And the guy's wife stopped him and said, you mustn't contend with scripture. And the other guy in the room, and I'm going to name him, bless him, Dieter Roman, the wonderful German psychologist, said,
here's the Dieter.
Absolutely. He himself at the time was a Christian, but he looked at my friends and he said, you are starting to sound like cult members. And that point where you can't discuss something, it's too emotional because your certainties are being shaken. It's causing cognitive dissonance. So I think it's important to be able to have conversations and to not feel frightened that the demon is influencing you.
Right. This is why my most favorite philosopher has been Charles Sanders Peirce. 19th century, he was considered the founder of pragmatism, although he didn't call it that. But he said that the first rule of reason is to not block the way of inquiry. You know, so that was his path toward that. Yeah. And so when you find a group blocking the way of inquiry, you've got cult flags flying. Yeah.
Absolutely. Freedom of association, freedom of speech, freedom of anything, ultimately. Fantastic.
Anyway.
Wonderful talking with you. And
same here. Yeah,
let's
very
get
good.
Together in a
anyway, so go ahead and show them the book.
Yep. We'll sell them the book.
Okay.
Brandon.
Take care.
Yeah.
Bye, John.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.